Welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar,
the podcast where we mix a sometimes weird but always delicious cocktail of theology, philosophy, and spirituality.
Today we have a fun episode. We always have fun episodes. Who am I kidding? Like, give me a break. We wouldn't put this out if it wasn't fun. But it's also a heavy episode. It's a serious episode. We're going to be talking to a woman named Tiffany Bloom, who wrote the book Pray Tell. And it's about abuse and about harassment and assault, and it's about oppression of women and how we can actually create a new way forward together. It's serious, it's important, and it was a great interview. Tiffany was just so fun to talk to.
But
before we do that, I don't know if I'm excited or if I'm filled with dread because of what I'm looking at. I am looking at a stout.
So I promised early on the podcast that I would make you guys drink some barrel-aged stouts. And then the pandemic happened and we weren't recording in person. And now we're all vaccinated and in person again.
Cheers to vaccinations.
It is stout time. So I have picked probably some beer snobs would debate me on this, but probably the best stout made in Wisconsin.
Okay.
In terms of just, I don't know, barrel craft, I suppose.
Let me guess. Central Waters?
It is Central Waters.
Oh, got it.
That is the truth. This is an annual release they do called Black Gold.
Oh, I've had this.
The name tells you everything you need to know. There are no adjuncts, which means they don't add anything to this beer. It's just everything you taste is from the barrel. And this is from last year, 2020, which is a highly regarded year.
What could sometimes be added to a beer?
Oh my God, anything you could think of.
Really?
Yeah, it's super, super popular to load all sorts of extra stuff into barrel-aged stouts, from vanilla to coconut to chocolate to cinnamon to...
Isn't that cheating?
Chilies are some of my favorite. Oh yeah, it's absolutely cheating. Yeah, but if everybody... Yeah. It's like in sports. I'm about to make a sports analogy. You ready for it?
Here we go.
When everybody's doping, is it really cheating?
Yes, it still is. It clearly still is. There's a reason why Barry Bonds will not be in the Hall of Fame. Don't get me started on sports, Kyle.
But this is none of that, so the purists out there can drink it and appreciate it. So.
I mean, you're not able to see this, listeners, but this looks like just straight up coffee. There's no head to
opaque.
It. Fully
opaque.
Yeah, and it's that's
And we
dark.
Should drink this like we would drink a whiskey. There's a nose, there's a palate, there's a finish, and they all have their own notes.
Okay.
I mean, think about it. All the interesting flavors coming from a whiskey barrel.
All right, Professor.
The nose is actually delicious.
Yeah,
it's chocolatey.
It's like
Sour chocolate smell.
It's like fresh wood chips to me.
Oh,
like a just ground up a hickory stump.
I'm not with you, but I like it.
Juice it up, stick it in my glass.
It's like chocolate gone bad. If chocolate can go bad, I don't.
Like I get the chocolate.
No, like a really dark, like an 80% or something. Cocoa
smells good. Here we go.
Oh, still chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Very chocolate.
Wow. Holy moly. Just heavy on the tongue.
Knowing that there is no chocolate in that is what's...
See, that's not cheating. Yeah. That right there, you'd be like, wow, who put in Hershey's?
Exactly.
Or dark chocolate?
That's thick. It's the...
Mm-hmm.
It's got the viscosity of molasses.
Like 10 seconds after I swallowed it,
that's
coffee.
Another really common adjunct, but not here. Yeah.
See, that's brilliant. I'm not a stout guy, but I can so appreciate the fact that like it tastes just straight up like chocolate.
Yep.
If I close my eyes at first, and then you get the coffee 10 seconds after.
Yep.
That's delightful. Like, good on you, Central Waters. That's crafted.
Yeah. I feel like I've had a Heath chocolate cake that tastes just like this.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Man,
good hints
I'm
of coconut
pissed.
In
You're
there.
Winning me over for stouts right now. But every stout tastes like Central Waters Black Gold. What would this set you back?
Another great thing about this beer is it doesn't really have much of a secondary value because they make it in large quantities. So if you're in Wisconsin, you can reliably find this at Cost, which is about $25.
You said this is the best stout in Wisconsin.
It is certainly
how close
one
is it,
of the best.
How close is it to just the best stout?
Not even.
Not even close.
I love you, Central Waters, but there's Wisconsin good, and then there's Nation good.
Oh, shut up.
and this is... amongst other non-adjunct stouts, it can definitely hold its own.
Okay.
I'll say that.
So. You listeners who enjoy our tastings, there might be like three dozen of you, let us know what you want us to taste. We get product from our friends at Story Hill BKC, but we'd be interested in hearing what you'd like to hear our reviews about.
Yeah, if you just send us bottles,
that's
fine. We would take that too. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We will not commit just to ideas here. Talking about the bottles you send us on the podcast, but we will commit to tasting them.
Absolutely.
I feel like we could commit to talking about the first bottle that somebody sends us.
Okay.
Sure.
It better be good,
and
though.
If you know, it's incentive to send us really good stuff. If you want it on the podcast, then make sure it's decent.
Yeah.
So, Tiffany Bloom, thanks so much for joining us.
It is such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So part of our podcast theme is that we're a pastor and a philosopher walking into a bar, so we always have something to drink next to us. So if there's anything you happen to be drinking that you want to tell us about, feel free.
There is
no pressure.
You know what? I feel like a lightweight to the party, so forgive me for not coming with a fancier drink. But I have a decaf fair trade French press with some caramel nut pods.
Okay.
Nice. Got hit up that nut pod life. And you, what are you drinking?
Respectable. Oh, this is Evan Williams, Kentucky and Straight Bourbon.
We're each drinking bourbon. Yeah, sorry, yeah, we're degenerates.
I know.
I'm sorry, where do you live? Is this appropriate at whatever time of day it is where you're at?
Oh, yeah, we're in Milwaukee. It is appropriate at every time of day.
Yes.
Okay, true story. Some of the best sushi I've had was in Milwaukee.
Get out of
right
here.
By the stadium.
Whoa.
You're from the West Coast, and you're saying some of the best sushi you've ever had is in Milwaukee?
The company was delightful. So let me just say that. Yeah. I was very hungry. And we have very good sushi here. And the place we went, they fly in their sushi every morning to this little place in Milwaukee.
Do you remember the name of it?
I don't know, but it's right across from the stadium.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
We can find that process of elimination. Yeah. Yeah. Tiffany, could you just tell us and our listeners a little bit about yourself and why you wrote this book?
Absolutely. Again, my name's Tiffany Bloom. I'm an author, a speaker, and a podcaster. I have a podcast called Why Though with fellow author Ashley Abercrombie, and we answer the existential questions we all ask ourselves about systemic injustice and our favorite frozen pizza and everything in between. I am a mom. I've got two little boys. I live here in the Pacific Northwest. And my work is at the intersection of justice, women, and faith. And I wrote Pray Tell after my own experience of speaking truth to power and losing everything I held dear in the process. I was left to grapple with the societal, financial, and professional ramifications of speaking up, even when I wasn't the person who had been victimized. And I think for so many of us, we see on CNN or Christianity Today of these egregious acts. And I would say about every quarter, a good man or quote unquote good man falls and abuses his power at a woman's expense. And we wonder why. Mm-hmm. Why did he get away with it for so long? Why didn't anybody speak up? Why didn't she say anything? So my hope is to really answer how these things happen, why they continue to happen, and how we can prevent them from happening in the future.
Again, the book is Pray Tell. We've interviewed a number of, I would say, really important books in this last probably 6 months or so. Kristen Cobes-Dumais, Jesus and John Wayne, and Beth Allison Barr in The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and A Church Called Tove from the Scott McKnight and Lauren Berringer. Really, I mean, if what I've said a couple of times is that it feels like we're at a moment of reckoning, particularly in the church.
Yeah. In the past, there's been this belief that to speak up against any infractions that have happened within the church walls would be to hurt the witness of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we are finding that that's not the case and that our God will not be shaken. We're part of this unshakable kingdom. And when we refuse to call out the sin within the camp, if you will, we are doing more harm than good. And we are protecting no good name or good gospel when we are willing to sacrifice those who call upon the Lord, those who are faithful, when we're willing to sacrifice them to keep a reputation, to keep a name of a church. We're really wading into some dirty water. And more than that, we are willing to protect men who have no need for protection. Mm. We're willing to defend men with some really faulty theology, which we can get into. Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous, it's harmful. And in fact, it's one of the leading reasons that women are leaving the church. And beyond that, you know, it's not a woman's education, resources, religious beliefs that will determine her trajectory in life. It is if a man will abuse his power at her expense. That is the leading factor and how her life will play out. So with that knowledge, we have a role as bystanders, as followers of Jesus. We have a moral, ethical, and Christian obligation to stand up, speak up, and address these issues that we have decided are completely acceptable to treat women this way.
Well, first of all, I think, Tiffany, you need to put an extra descriptor of what you do behind your name, author, podcaster, preacher, because clearly that's good stuff. This book, I mentioned those other books, this book felt different for me right from the jump, and particularly because you're not coming at it from a historical perspective, like Dume, you're not, or in Barr, you're not coming at it from a data statistical perspective. You're coming at it from more, even though there is data in statistics and history in the book, it felt more like your lived experience as a woman in the church and in this world that we live in. That was what you wrote about. And it was visceral, and it did something different to me as I read through this book. It made me reflect on staff meetings that I have with an all-female staff. I'm the only male on our church staff. It made me reflect on things that I say, things that I just flippantly do. And it really kind of moved me a little bit and disturbed me into thinking I'm guilty of a lot of things in this book, even though I'd like to champion myself as an egalitarian and feminist and the whole deal. Was that your intent from the beginning, that lived experience on display of women today?
Yeah, my lived experience, but all through modern stories that we all know of everybody from Monica Lewinsky to Anita Hill to, victims of church abuse that we know in the last couple of years. I wanted to illuminate it through these common stories that we are familiar with, but we might not understand the nuanced backstory. And more than that, I specifically wanted to address, and you hit the nail on the head, is how even egalitarian spaces are guilty of this. In the context I was in, it was egalitarian through and through. Choosing to work in faith spaces for the majority of my career, I heard that women are equal to men. That was out the gate in high school. Women were preaching and teaching. And so I had this model to me that you can do what men do. You are just as valuable, inherently worthy. Your word matters. And then when the girl who plays by all the rules finds herself between a rock and a hard place and realizes the people who set the rules weren't there for her benefit, then what are we left with? It's really so disconcerting and disjointed in how we're treating women when we can champion, just as you said, egalitarian practices. But if we aren't examining how those play out in the everyday lived experience, we might hurt and harm in ways we never intended to.
And I want to say this book should be read by everyone. Really important book, particularly for men. And if you feel like, oh, I'm really progressive and I treat women great, read it, because it's going to make you reflect. It's going to make you it's going to just make you a better human being. In the book, Tiffany, you bring us into a woman's lived perspective, navigating a world that's been designed to repress and corral women. But you articulate also how much more pronounced that oppression and abuse is for women of color. You as a woman of color as well. I liked that. I liked reading that. Again, this is not my lived experience, but differentiating white women and women of color, that's a two different experiences. Can you bring us into that world a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. In the last, I would say 250 years, we have seen varied responses when women come forward with an inconvenient truth. And you look back at just as slavery ended, there was women who wanted to press charges against former slave owners. And they were told by magistrates, unless you can prove that you didn't enjoy it, you have no case here. Wow. And then you would see white women come forward against black men who they claimed had taken advantage of their body or their reputation or their time. And those men were given severe consequences. And even as white men who harmed these white women, their testimonies were heard, consequences were given out appropriately. And so over the years, abuse of power against women is happening equally to women of color, to white women, but the response to it is, again, so varied. So now you look in our modern day, black women are 2 to 3 times more likely in the workplace to be harassed. Indigenous women are 2.5 times more likely than any other people group to be taken advantage of, harassed, manipulated, abused, assaulted. And you have Latin women who are the least likely to be believed, especially based on their immigration status. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you bring in Asian women like myself. I'm South Asian. We are seen to be meek or cold or quiet or hypersexual. Black women also have that stereotype placed upon them. And what happens is these stereotypes by themselves, you think, oh, it's just a stereotype. But when both ministers and magistrates get on board to believe that these stereotypes are true about them, and then consequences are in line with those stereotypes, not only are those women not heard, the perpetrators of power are not held responsible. They're able to use those stereotypes as excuses and hold up their accolades over a woman's accusations.
So you write, I think this is chapter 2, about narcissism in the church, and not just in the church, but I'm interested specifically on your take on why narcissists seem to thrive so well in the church specifically, and how many of them end up at the top. I remember seeing a Canadian study a few years ago. It was like a shocking percentage of church leaders that they surveyed ranked pretty high on a narcissistic personality disorder scale, you know?
Why is everyone staring at me?
So say a bit about how the church context might actually encourage narcissistic behavior and how that can actually shield the abuser from consequences.
Yeah. So first, let's give a baseline definition of narcissism for those who might be wondering quite exactly what that means. And when we're talking about narcissism for this conversation, we are talking about a distorted view of reality where the narcissist only exists to have their agenda met and everyone around them serves as supply. They are there to supply the demand of what that narcissist wants to see. It's their way or the highway. Unless you are willing to bend their way on every issue, on everything, you're no longer needed, necessary, or you are an enemy. So that's just our baseline there of narcissism. Now, interestingly, those who gain power in faith spaces, it is because of the fruit of the Spirit in their life. It is because of the virtues that they espouse, and it's been seen, it's been noticed, it's been elevated. And then on their ascent to power, they seem to lose those virtues and replace them with quote unquote leadership qualities that very much mirror narcissistic tendencies, but we mask them in the language of the scriptures.
Yes.
We'll say, you know, I'm the one God anointed, and I'm the one with the vision from God. And if you're not on board, then get off the bus. Mm-hmm. Or we will continue to say, you know, come under my scepter of responsibility and come under my scepter of power, and I'm going to take care of you. And I vividly remember somebody saying to me, I'm the daddy of this house. Ooh. I'm the one who calls the shots. And it's this idea that it's their way or the highway. And without a healthy board and a healthy staff to keep someone like that in check, it can be easy to see that power continue to grow without any restraint. And research shows that men who continue to ascend to power without healthy accountability see themselves as more desirable sexually, relationally, that they're deserving of anything they want, and they will seek it out regardless if it's consensual. Now, I'm just not talking about sexual here. I'm talking about you walk into somebody's office and say, you need to do this. Why? Because I'm in charge. Knowing that there's such little ramifications for themselves, but that middle management or lower management person, whether you're in a faith space, corporate America, wherever, that person doesn't feel they have the liberty, resources, or agency to speak up because there will be consequences for them. So when there is a lack of accountability, you see those narcissistic tendencies really start to swell where perhaps they weren't so prevalent in the beginning. And again, it's without accountability that it can really, really go wrong. Now, do we think every leader is a narcissist? Absolutely not. But the fact is, narcissism is comfortable. It feels good. And it gets the job done from that person's point of view. So they're thinking, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? They can see it as, this isn't me trying to control everyone or everybody. This is me honoring the vision that God's given me. Mm-hmm. So being able to step back and really have a posture of humility is required to hold that tension of leadership and servanthood. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could do a whole episode on what pastor means. It's the shepherd of a flock and Jesus' call to serve in the last shall be first and the first shall be last. We could do a whole thing. We'll just remind you listeners of that's what a pastor, that's what a leader in the church is supposed to be. That's what the call from the Apostle Paul. And man, has it gone sideways. And I do want to say this. I want to give this little mid-episode disclaimer. There might be some men who are listening, if you're still listening, and you're a little turned off. You've got this little, I don't want to say little because I don't want to belittle us men. But we've got this little fragile ego where we're starting to say, maybe even us white men in particular, we're saying, man, it's hard to be a white man today in this world. You know, like we're taking shots from every which way. Dang. Nope. You don't get to say that. Yeah, but I mean, have you heard in the news how they're just killing us white men? Nope. Just shush. Just quiet. Here's our job. Here's your job. Here's my job as a white man. Listen.
Yeah.
That's the whole job. That's it. It's
the
just
whole job. Listen and be an ally. And I think what a privilege to be a white man in ministry, in corporate America, in education, in politics,
give
and
me
entertainment.
A break.
You have such an opportunity to leverage your platform and your power and your resources to uplift so many. And I hope you do that. I am the product of good white male mentors who saw goodness and capability and skill in me and leveraged not only their resources, but their connections to advance my space. So I am just, I think, honestly, can I shout out to a good white man? Is that okay?
Absolutely.
In my situation, when I spoke truth to power, the first person I called was a mentor of mine who I had had since I was 18. And I said, this is the situation. This is what I know. And I am terrified. I know I have everything to lose if I speak up. And he said to me, you don't have to do something about this. We will do something about this.
There
he included himself in the solution. Mm-hmm. And it's something I'm so grateful for, because I think for so many of us, abuse of power can feel like it's happening in a vacuum, and it's very much not. Others are likely affected by that abuse of power. But when another chooses to lend their strength, when another chooses to share that burden, who might not have the emotional load that you might be carrying, there's something really beautiful to that, to be able to walk that out in wholeness and healing and justice and resurrection.
Yep. And second disclaimer, just in case you're like, we've been talking about women and feminism and oppression a lot on this podcast. Can we be done? Or the world's been talking about feminism for a long time. Can we just, we've changed some laws. We've done the things. Let's move on. Sorry, that's not the way it works. Something that is millennia in taking root, grew roots for millennia, means that we're going to have to spend a long time disassembling it and burning it and sweeping the ashes aside. So just get used to it. It's okay. So Tiffany, in chapter 3, you talk a lot about the silencing of women. And I had one of those out-of-body experiences when you were talking about the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearing, and then the Brett Kavanaugh, and what's the woman's name?
Dr. Kristen Blasey Ford.
Dr. Kristen Blasey Ford. And I felt, I had this realization that we've grown up, and we all look like about the same age. You're younger than us, for sure, than me, I'll say.
Good skincare, guys.
Yeah.
I'm Asian, remember?
But I'll speak for myself. I feel like I've grown up in a generation that's watched trial after trial for sexual harassment, whether it be for Supreme Court justices or other politicians, where a woman says, he did this to me, and she's brought front and center, asked all these questions, grilled, and then every time, I mean, pretty much every time, we believe the man, thanks, give ourselves a pat on the back that we did our due diligence, and then we walk away. Now, I'm just realizing as you wrote that, Tiffany, that I've been conditioned culturally to just, that's the process that we do, and then we walk away and it's no big deal, right? Like there's no consequences at all. We just went through an election with a famous abuser, and then the other candidate that we thought was a good grandpa who had accusations thrown at him as well, and we heard about it for about 2 weeks, and then it just went away. Don't care anymore. This is the world we live in. Can you speak to what this does, what this cycle of silencing tells other victims, the multitudes of victims that are out there wondering if they can raise their voice and tell their story and have somebody held accountable?
Yeah, I think specifically when I think of Dr. Kristen Blasey Ford, for many of me and my friends, it was watching, are we safe? Is it safe to come out and be honest? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. Women feel so unsafe because we still will hold up a good man and his character or perceived character and how he makes us feel over a woman's honest experience. She is disposable. And you've had incredible people on that you can tell you why historically we believe that women are disposable. And from the first century to our modern day, this belief that women are inherently evil. And they're Tertullian, my favorite of the early church father, oh, the gateway, the gateway to the enemy. You know, there's this belief that women aren't capable of telling the truth. And, you know, in the first century, one historian says that women could not hold testimony in a court of law because it was either for personal gain or for fear of punishment. They were quite literally incapable of telling the truth. So that's permeated our culture today. And of course, in the last 20 years of the cases you just mentioned, this idea that women aren't trustworthy and women are incapable of telling the truth. Therefore, we can interview them, we can ask those questions, but we will continue to employ confirmation bias of what we believe about these quote unquote good men and continually affirm who we believe they are, even if there's clear evidence otherwise, because if we don't, we have to address our own bias of how we treat women. And we have to realize that we've given allegiance and trust to a man who doesn't deserve it. Mm-hmm. And we would rather dispose of a woman in her testimony, her honest testimony, mm-hmm. than believe that the whole structure needs examination and restructuring.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And that's not to even think about the trauma that she went through, even thinking about coming forward and testifying before the whole world about this trauma that happened to her. I can't imagine. And then to be discarded, like you're disposable and your story isn't real, it makes me like viscerally angry.
Yeah.
Let's poke into that for a second, because one of the reasons they decided to dismiss her case, and I say this because it's a perfect example for so many cases, is that she couldn't recall accurately the events in chronological order, which in fact, research shows is evidence of trauma, where the brain, almost like a scrambled egg, will scramble those events because it is so traumatic to even think of them. And the body will react in such a way, in such an inflammatory response, that to protect the body, it will scramble it because it's so painful to relive. Yet we put a woman on the stand, or we put a woman before a church board, or we put a woman on blast because she can't accurately string those events together. And in reality, that is actually proof of her harm.
And I'm not even convinced, honestly, that a lot of the people that voted to confirm didn't believe her.
Sure.
I think there were plenty that did, but
I agree.
Couldn't make themselves see it as evidence that counted towards something they were obligated to do.
Yep.
Because it didn't fall into that category. I remember seeing, while the trial was ongoing, they stopped Orrin Hatch in the hallway and asked him what his thoughts were. And he said, literally, "I think she's an attractive, nice woman." Like, you could see, you almost see the wheels, like, trying to process what was happening in a way that he just didn't have the tools for. And so it just came out as bald sexism.
let's not, you know, try to vilify politicians who are scumbags and don't care. I mean, we had a 2016 election where the Republican candidate talked about, and we had every single person heard this coverage of him talking about grabbing women by the genitals and bragging about it. And we had about a half a day, like a 12-hour moment where everyone was like, maybe I can't vote for him anymore. And then turns out 82% of evangelicals voted for him, and probably what, upper 60% of Catholics voted for him. I mean, let's just be real honest. It seems like none of us really care about women's stories. It seems like very few of us care about taking abuse, harassment, assault, rape, all of this seriously one bit, because 82% and 69%. Yeah. I mean, that's just the numbers.
And that's where you get into this understanding that it's all about proximity to power. Why will we exchange firsthand knowledge between Billy Bush and 45, knowing what happened on that Access Hollywood bus? Why will we exchange that for why? Because we want power. And if this person will advance our place in the system, then we'll take it. We will always care about number one, which is so anti-gospel, as we know. But this idea that we will stay silent, we will continue to let abuse of power at a woman's expense continue if we can have our proximity to power. This was a phenomena that really was on display at Fox News with Roger Ailes when Gretchen Carlson had audio tape of Roger Ailes abusing his power and speaking poorly about her and her body and her reputation and her ability and her skills, just so, so degrading. And even with that audio, women came out of the woodworks to support Roger. And I've seen it again and time again in research for Pray Tell. Women are the first line of defense. Why? Because they have internalized their proximity to that power. And if they want to stay in any sort of inner circle, then they are going to protect the number one at all costs because they don't want to lose their place in the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And it really is a dark day when women turn on other women to protect men, to protect men who don't deserve to be protected and to protect men who've abused their power. And so you see how not only abuse of power at women's expense harms the women, you are quite literally dividing people. And I'm specifically talking of women here, but all of us, like you said, over 80% of Americans who follow Jesus decided that this was still the man for the job. And so just this idea that we're willing to exchange power, willing to exchange, well, this person's disposable if you can advance what I believe should happen or what I want or where I want to be. And so Pray Tell is really, it's not about the 10% who are absolute monsters. It's about the 90% of us who we all are watching these things play out in our churches, in our workplaces, every place we work and worship, the gym, the playgroup, I don't care where you at. We witness this abuse of power and we think, not my circus, not my monkeys. I don't need to handle this. And in reality, it is your job. It is not, the onus is not on a woman to escape abuse of power. It is on all of us to stand up for her, and it's on men to behave justly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And let me just say, I'm just going to pause for a second. Try to pass through the moment again. Like, listeners, I'm sure you're listening right now and you're like, this is heavy, because I'm feeling it. Like, I don't think I've ever felt this kind of physical heaviness and weight to an interview. I would call that, maybe as a good charismatic, like the grieving of the Holy Spirit, perhaps. But I'm encouraging you, don't give up on this. If you got to push pause to take a time out because it's heaviness, do it. But then come back, because we need to talk about these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about some more specific ways that women are silenced in the church. Talk a little bit about NDAs and how those get used and your feelings about those, because I know you have some. And other ways, I suppose, that church leaders and boards find very creative ways to keep these stories from coming out.
Yeah. Interestingly, NDAs have been one of the only saving graces for many women when they've been harmed and feel any sort of redress or restitution for their harm. But in reality, what we're doing with non-disclosure agreements, secret settlements, whatever you want to call them, is we're saying that, especially within church settings, we're saying that this harm happened, but you can't tell anybody because we don't want to hurt the reputation of this church, because that's more important than what's happened to you and your restoration process. And our church and the name of our church and the reputation of our church and the reputation of our leaders and the reputation of those who might have committed that harm is more important than seeing you walk out that restoration. Now, do we need to protect women who've been harmed? Does their name need to be released? Absolutely not. But do we need to still be honest about what has happened? Because if we don't, two things. Number one, when you aren't completely honest about any sort of abusive power that's happened, especially in faith settings, you are leaving it up to the abuser of power to determine the narrative. And I will guarantee you, he will. And I say he because 80% of these issues are unfortunately male-led. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Secondly, with NDAs, you can come into a work environment or a church environment and think, this is they have the ethos I've been waiting for. This is the kind of place I've always wanted to work and worship the Lord in and help build the kingdom. And in reality, you are dropped into a fish tank of piranhas and you have no idea, because every woman who's been eaten alive before you hasn't had permission to tell. Whoa. Hasn't had permission to tell her story. And again, it negates any further examination of the system and how it might be enabling and protecting an abuser of power. Because it's that ring of enablers who do all that dirty work. They're the ones writing payoff checks. They're the ones, you know, erasing calendar events that when an investigation comes, I didn't have that meeting there. They're the ones doing the digging and erasing emails and clearing servers. They're the ones doing all those things more than likely. So it's that second ring who are really, really, really need some examination to see what is harming those who are here, what is helping those, and what does justice actually look like? Because justice doesn't look like an NDA. I can think of so many women who've signed NDAs, ones that I've researched for Pray Tell, ones that I know personally, who legitimately thought this is my only way to have any sort of closure. And in reality, NDAs, they're so, so tightly written in like Fort Knox that you likely can't talk to a therapist, a mentor, your spouse, any future pastor about what you have encountered. Now, when we look at scripture, scripture invites us to bear our burdens with one another. Scripture invites us to walk out our restoration in community. And we are saying in a very house of faith, you'll do no such thing.
Yep. Yep. I just want to say, if you're looking, if you're listening and you're looking for a job at a church and you come across an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, go find a job at another church. And if you're leading a church, you're listening and you have NDAs, that's your, that's a common practice that you do at your church, man, submit that before the Lord and like burn those up, because that is not the gospel.
Isn't there a Bible verse about nothing hidden that shall not be revealed or something? That sounds familiar. It's almost like I read that somewhere.
Even more on that, just one last thing. The NDAs are even scarier, that if you don't sign this NDA, we will sue you. We will sue you for character defamation. I can't tell you how many pastors have whispered that across the boardroom in their congregation, sign this or we'll sue you for coming after us. How, talk about a rock and a hard place. And that's why these NDAs, again, I know I've tried to give as much context as possible, but at the end of it, you will struggle in silence or we'll destroy you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good Lord. Yeah. So what do you say to, because I know there are probably listeners out there thinking this, what do you say to people, probably men, probably white men, who are concerned about false reporting? And they might say something along the lines of, look, I agree, abuse is bad, it's awful, women shouldn't be treated that way, we shouldn't sweep it under the rug, but character assassination's bad too, false reporting's bad too, that's something you're not going to get off your, you know, that's going to be with you for the rest of your life. And now we have this movement after Me Too of this, you know, believe women slogan, something you talk about in the book. And some men will want to say, well, sure, we should believe the honest women, right? We should, or we should, you know, believe the ones that are telling the truth, but maybe not take it so far as like a blanket, this is our disposition to believe all women. What is your response to that kind of concern? Why do you think that's an illegitimate concern?
You know, it's interesting. This is one of the most common questions of the 80 plus interviews I've done around Pray Tell. And it's been mostly from white men asking. So I'm glad you're staying on that streak. And my answer is, I hope, one of encouragement. And it's this. First, it's around 1% of any sort of case that goes to trial or is reported with local police that turns out to be false. 1%. That is very low. So the likelihood that a woman would willingly sacrifice herself on the altar to ruin a man, very unlikely, because she's very aware, as we just talked about, as we talked about Dr. Kristen Blasey Ford, she's the one who will never be able to get a job again. She's the one who won't be able to carry on. She's the one who will have the scarlet letter for the rest of her life, not the man. Furthermore, it is the role of a man in those situations. If you think, man, I don't want to be accused of false reporting, I can help you prevent that. And it's just a few little ways. First, consider the power dynamics. Race, obviously gender, as we're talking about between men and women. Physical size, that's an often overlooked power dynamic between men and women that women very much are aware of when they're having an exchange with a man. And then of course, reputation. Do you have a reputation as someone who's kind, benevolent, generous? And if something were to happen, people will, you know, they're going to believe you over her, or is, what's her reputation like? So being conscious of that in every situation, you know, I remember I was speaking at a church, the senior pastor followed me into the green room and he shut the door behind him. And that man meant no harm. I can guarantee you he meant no harm, but he wanted to talk to me. He was like, oh, tell me more about this story or this point that you shared. But when he closed that door behind him, here I am, a 30 something brown woman, a guest in a city that I've never been to. And then I'm flying out that afternoon. And this man who is got a well-known reputation, and here we are, and anything could happen. And he's taller than me. He's older than me. He's got a platform larger than mine. And I was so aware, like, he could say anything or do anything. And I felt like the sitting duck. And so if we want to talk about, we don't want false accusations, I would encourage you to consider those dynamics in every interaction that you have with women. Again, physical size, reputation, obviously gender, and class as well. Mm-hmm. Just knowing that there's a difference there and there's how women will be seen or how they perceive you. So if you don't want to be accused of making a woman uncomfortable, well before we're to harassment and assault, if you don't want to be accused of making a woman uncomfortable, consider those dynamics in every exchange and think about, man, from her point of view, I wonder what this feels like. Here I am, a foot taller than her. I'm speaking louder than her. I have more power than her. Maybe I'm telling her to do something or go somewhere. Just to be wary of those dynamics.
Yeah, that's good. Tiffany, we hit on this in the beginning of the interview, the idea of male allyship. And I want to read an excerpt from your book because it was just like all over the place in your book, so startling and clear. You say, gendered oppression will continue so long as women are the ones tasked with solving the issue. When in reality, this issue exists in large part due to abusive power rooted in toxic masculinity, not weak femininity. This issue is a man's issue as much as it is a woman's issue, if not more so. It is decidedly not enough for men not to harass, assault, silence, slander, and destroy women. You're calling men into allyship. And can you describe this reality that says, well, I'm not sexist. I don't assault women. You know, I do good enough. Can you describe what is needed from men, our responsibility, and what a male ally looks like, sounds like, acts like?
Yeah, what a great question. You really illuminated this about 20 minutes ago, and you said, first, we just must listen. Mm-hmm. We must listen because we'd like to assume we know what other people are going through. Yeah. But the reality is we filter everything through our own family of origin, lived experience, religious upbringing, so on and so forth, all of our power dynamics and different, you know, our different identities that we hold together in tension. So being able to simply listen to a woman's point of view and being willing to hear what she has to say and doing so without judgment of thinking, that's not how it happens here. I don't see it like that. Withholding judgment is key. And we must consider our facial expressions. We must consider our body language in that. Simply listen. And then secondly, we have to be willing to not only listen to a woman's account and listen to what she thinks might be necessary for change or for restoration, but then enact that and allow her to be part of that process, not think we know what she needs, but continually have that dialogue with her. What does this look like? Now, that can swing two ways. One, we can either shut her down, or two, a man can be put on a pedestal because he'll give women even a shred of time. And that's not what we're going for either. This is not the idea of like, look at me, I'm this awesome feminist man who's out to help women. It's like, no, I am going to use my place, whatever that may be, whatever semblance of power I have, to ensure that women are heard, women are valued, women are believed, and women are uplifted. And that's outrageously practical. And if you're at work and you are getting opportunities and promotions, and maybe you haven't even worked for them that hard, who knows? Maybe you have. I believe you're a hard worker, whoever's listening. But you can think of Jade in the next cubicle, who's just as capable. Being willing to sacrifice yourself so Jade can have advancement in her career, advancement in the workplace, or advancement in church. If there's women who are clearly capable for leadership positions within the church, but they're continually giving to X number of men, being like, you know what? I do believe I'm qualified for that. But you know who's also qualified is so-and-so. If you want to talk about allyship, that's what it's looked like. And we have to put our money where our mouth is, because this will not change unless men see themselves as part of the answer. In fact, they're half of the answer, if not more. And one other thing that I think we sometimes psychologically overlook is that men in the workplace who are overtly egalitarian are, on the whole, seen as weak, research shows. They're seen as pandering to women by men in the workplace that they work with, but also other women. I want to illuminate that because it points to the societal influence of how we believe men who practice egalitarian ways in the places that they work and worship are being treated. So you can see how they might continually step back from being an ally or advocate in any manner, because when they do, they've been treated as weak. So we have to step this back and think, it isn't enough to simply, as I mentioned, you know, refrain from harassment or assault or catcalling or, you know, locker room talk. We have got to be willing to be seen as weak as men. We've got to be willing to be seen as maybe I am helping women, but not at the expense of men. It's because we're in partnership. Partnership is always the goal. Yeah. This isn't some feminist manifesto. This is truly, let's all work together because this is going to destroy us all.
Yeah, this is the gospel. Yep.
Another person viewed as weak. Jesus.
Yeah. You had to get all Jesus-y and say, like, we have to be willing to be seen as weak, Tiffany. You burst my bubble because right in that moment I was thinking, oh, egalitarian men are seen as weak? Come at me, bro. Like, whatever. But then you brought Jesus.
Yeah, the solution is not to make yourself appear tough anyway. It's to just allow yourself to be perceived that. A great example is my own personal moral exemplar, Fred Rogers, who comes up in your book. Somebody that, yeah, everybody thought he was weak and effeminate. And
okay, a little behind the scenes. I legit wanted to pitch to my publisher my next book be about what does masculinity look like? Mm-hmm. And Fred, basically writing... Wow. A biography on Fred Rogers, wow. Because mm-hmm. feelings are mentionable and manageable. Right. And, you know, it's wild how from the age of 13 is when boys start to realize if I want to be seen as a quote unquote man, I have to demean women. Oof. It's hard to find a middle school girl who hasn't been harassed. It's almost impossible. Why? Because he wants to be seen as a man to the boys in his class, but also to the girls. And wow. So we start this culture and this abuse of power so young, and then we see it in fraternity culture, and then we take that into adult life, and then we take that into the places we worship, and we see how we've normalized a culture of abuse, and it's one that we can fix.
Oh, man. I mean, Tiffany, you just right there dropped this bomb that's going to change the way I parent. I've got a 12-year-old son who is petrified of girls. But I mean, it's an innocent thing, it seems like, mm-hmm. but it quickly could go into demeaning girls, women. And like you just changed a little bit of the way I'm going to parent my boys. So thank you. Like parents, listen up. 13-year-olds, that's crazy.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC, and if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's storyhillbkc.com.
So coming to the end of our time here, we talked to a lot of people about some dark, heavy stuff. This is one of those conversations we've had.
It seems like quite a few in a row.
Exactly. It's not an accident that we have alcohol next to us. So we've decided that at the end of most of our interviews, we're going to ask a version of the question, what's a better way? To try to end on a hopeful note if possible. And there is some hope in your book in the midst of all of the uncomfortable facts and the darkness. I mean, you talk about building a culture in which women are believed and boys are taught respect and kindness and ownership of their own desires and stewardship of their emotions. So what's a better way?
Yeah. We first must lament. We must lament that this is happening. So many of us are still in denial. We don't want to believe that good men are capable of bad things. But if we can lament and consider our proximity to power and how we have personally benefited when women have been taken advantage of, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's at our church, whether it's in politics, when we first see how we've been part of the problem, then we can begin to be part of the solution. And then we have to listen, as we've talked about, and then we have to learn how these things happen or they will continue to go unchecked. And finally, we've got to love, and love is not divorced from justice. Mm. Don't believe anyone who tells you otherwise. We often are forcing women into this quick forgiveness of, you know, you're not spiritually mature if you aren't willing to forgive what's happened to you and forgive this man without repentance. And the reality is that this woman is entitled to justice. Why? Because my Bible tells me so. And it's our honor. It's our honor to walk out that justice with her. Justice for not just the perpetrator, but for those who've been harmed.
Mm-hmm. That's good, Tiffany. As you talk, I'm inspired because if anyone can do that, the church, the people who follow Jesus, the people of the gospel, we've got to be able to do that, right? That's what we do.
Let's lead the way.
Tiffany, where can people find you? Where can they buy your books?
Yeah, everything at tiffanybloom.com. All kinds of goodies. And of course, links to your favorite indie and mainstream retailers. And for the everyday, I hang out mostly on Instagram at Tiffany Bloom.
Nice. Well, again, the book is Pray Tell. And I would put it on the must read list, especially after this interview.
For sure. Grief. If you're a fan of those other books Randy mentioned, this is definitely in your wheelhouse. So check it out.
I have to tell you something quite funny. That was called the Christian Thanos, all those books that you mentioned. Pray Tell and Jesus and John Wayne, Making a Biblical Womanhood, Church Called Tove.
And it even kind of fits because like when you collect them all, you can equalize the universe.
You just broke Kyle with that. Well, Tiffany Bloom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, the honor's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please rate and review the podcast before you close your app. You can also share the episode with friends or family members with the links from our social media pages. Gain inside access, extra perks, and more at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. We're so grateful for your support of the podcast. Until next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.